This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, a wry novel imagines hipster culture in a fading industrial city during wartime. We'll talk with Vanessa Veselka about her literary debut, Zazen. And from a parallel America to the 10th parallel. That's the latitude, about 10 degrees above the equator, where two worlds collide. It's the topic of today's 11 for 11 conversation on big ideas for our time, and also the name of a book by the journalist and poet Eliza Griswold. She traveled to the megacities and remote villages of Central Africa and South Asia, where more than half of the world's 2 billion Christians live, along with half of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims. It is here, far from the Middle East, where disputes over ethnicity, land, water, and oil are shrouded in conflicts over faith. Griswold shifts the focus to the global south, where Muslim and Christian fundamentalism is churning out foot soldiers and suicide bombers who believe that they are in a clash of civilizations that is seeding the geopolitics of the future. Eliza Griswold will be reading at the Meeting House in historic Jaffrey Center on Friday evening. Her book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam, is now out in paperback. And she joins us now from WAMU in Washington. Eliza, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what is The Tenth Parallel? Who lives there and where is it?
The 10th parallel is the line of latitude about 700 miles north of the equator. So when you think of Africa, as I do, is shaped like a lumpy sock or a Christmas stocking, and you think of the northernmost third of the continent, which is desert, This is the space where desert meets the wetter south. And it's there where two different kinds of weather meet and two different kinds of land meet that two different kinds of religions meet as well. In Southeast Asia, In Southeast Asia, it's a little bit different due to the trade winds, but we'll get there.
What makes this latitude a target for rapidly growing fundamentalism, both among Christians and Muslims?
Well, the greatest trend toward growing fundamentalism is within both Christianity and Islam. There are decades-long patterns of reawakening going on. These reawakenings, or religious revivals, tend to send people back to their holy books and to literal interpretations of the word, as well as giving each believer a sense of a personal and direct relationship with God. Frequently, those understandings of a personal and direct relationship also include the idea that there's one and only one way to be saved, exclusivism. And if people believe that there's one way to be saved, it makes everybody else at best doomed, at worst an enemy. And those are the global patterns we see intensified in the global south.
Let's start with Sudan. You went to several countries, but some of the forces there brought Christianity and Islam to converge together. And you give a lot of that history about all the countries that you visited. What is it particularly there that Christianity and Islam sort of came together over?
Well, you know, reporting the book took me 7 years of traveling to these six countries across two continents and 9,000 miles. And how I did that is I would go and do case studies firsthand and then come back and do the research. And in Sudan in particular, I didn't know until I went there and people told me, and I went back and confirmed in the archives up at Harvard, where I was at the time, the history of the 10th parallel there. Now, what happened there is the British faced in the late 1800s the largest Islamic rebellion they ever had, the Mahdi Rebellion, and they lost. They lost to this charismatic, violent Islamic reformer. And when they came back and won over Sudan, they were somewhat reluctant that they had a million square miles, still the world's largest country, of course, world's largest country in Africa, but now, of course, split into two. They had this massive area to control. And what they decided is, you know, we're not going to face an uprising at the hands of Islam again. And in order to make sure that doesn't happen, we are not going to let Christian missionaries preach to Muslims. And so we are going to send those missionaries explicitly south of the 10th parallel, because that was the line they understood where the Islamic dry north began, and the wetter, and at that time, indigenous religions, what people called pagans at the time, lived south of the 10th parallel, because they were protected by ironically, the tsetse fly. The reason that Islam stopped along the 10th parallel over most of Africa, most of inland Africa, is that where the jungle began, so did the tsetse fly. And the tsetse carried sleeping sickness, and that sleeping sickness killed off the camels and the horses that the Muslim traders and missionaries used to carry the face south.
And this sort of began a long, complicated history of politicization of faith in Sudan and another place where being on the right side, maybe having access to goods and to water and to land and to money, often meant conversion. Tell us more about how that's played out up until now all over the place.
Sure. Well, one thing that I found to be absolutely true is there was no place where there was a religious conflict unfolding wherein that conflict didn't have absolute secular or worldly triggers, whether those were politics, a drought, even in Indonesia, control over crops of chocolate. There were always these interlinked realities on the ground. And it didn't mean that all of these conflicts boiled down to no religion. Religion was definitely involved because the people on the ground believe that they were fighting religious battles. But they all had secular triggers. So, you know, you see, for example, in Nigeria, where people have really fought over land quite a bit in what's called the Middle Belt. And in fact, a lot of those fights over land have taken on the color of what a Christian might call crusade there, or a Muslim might call jihad or holy war.
Well, where are the governments in this? I mean, I've traveled in Africa. Obviously, you did a great deal of traveling in Africa where there's a lot of failed states, there's a lack of services, government corruption. So does religion offer more than a government can?
That's exactly right. In many of the places, the reason some of these fault lines are so sharp along the 10th parallel is because where governments were arbitrarily drawn colonial boundaries, right, drawn hundreds and thousands of miles away by colonial administrators, where these countries exist on the ground, governments are weak at best and rapacious at worst. For example, you look at Nigeria, where, you know, America's fifth largest oil supplier, most Nigerians live on $1 to $2 a day. And because being a Nigerian means nothing, it doesn't even guarantee you the right to clean water, certainly not education or even electricity, other kinds of identity come to the fore. And even more than ethnicity or even race, religion becomes the primary form of identification.
Today's 11 for 11 conversation is with Eliza Griswold. She spent 7 years traveling along the band of the globe called the 10th parallel to find out how Christianity and Islam are lived every day by some of the world's most vulnerable people and how their interactions are influencing global politics. Eliza, you traveled there to Sudan in 2003 with Franklin Graham, where he met with Omar Hassan al-Bashir, the leader of Sudan. Tell us a little bit about that trip and Graham's mission and how it sort of framed this whole project for you.
It really did frame this project in that, okay, so I went with Franklin Graham, Billy's son, head of a half-billion-dollar evangelical empire, to meet with his sworn enemy, a man he'd called more evil than Saddam Hussein. So we went to the marble palace of Bashir, who, P.S., today stands indicted for war crimes by the International Criminal Court and crimes against humanity. This is the architect of Darfur, and long before Darfur, the modern world's bloodiest jihad against Christians and Muslims alike in the south of his country. So Graham is most famous for calling Islam a wicked and evil religion. And it was in Sudan that a lot of his opinions of the faith were formed. So when Graham told me he was going to Sudan, I asked if I could go along, and I was able to sit down with these two men as they met. And it was quite surreal. Both tried to convert the other, and that didn't go terribly well. And so essentially what happened is Graham reached into his pocket, and actually this is what I learned later, what Graham told me later, because I had been ushered into the driveway with everybody else as things got increasingly tense. But Graham reached into his pocket and he pulled out a George W. Bush 2004 re-election pin, and he gave it to Bashir and he said, "Mr. President, I understand you'll be speaking to my president later today. Why don't you tell him you're his first voter here in the Sudan?" Now, this is a man who's now been indicted for war crimes, crimes against humanity. And what the essence of that interaction was is, you know what? you're on notice. You're on notice, Bashir. The U.S. is watching what you're doing. And I am a faith-based emissary, come whether I say so or not, on behalf of the U.S. government. It felt like watching the nexus of faith and foreign policy unfold firsthand.
Well, and the nexus of faith is what we're talking about right now today. We'll be back in just a minute with an 11 for 11 conversation about the clash of civilizations taking place along the 10th parallel. Our guest, Eliza Griswold, spent 7 years traveling in the area where more than half of the world's, four-fifths of the world's Muslims and Christians live, and where traditional ethnic and newer resource conflicts are being layered with disputes over faith. It's here where fiery rhetoric has turned into violence in the Bali bombing, the Janjaweed, and where young fighters like the Christmas Day bomber are emerging. We'll be back with more 11 for 11 with Eliza Griswold on the fault lines between Christianity and Islam on Word of Mouth from NHPR.
10 ought to do it, don't you think? You think we need one more? All right, we'll get one more.
The numbers all go to 11.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
11. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there?
11.
And most of
11.
The
amps go up to 10.
Exactly. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 11. 11.
We're back with an 11 for 11 conversation with Eliza Griswold on the lives of the billions of Christians and Muslims living along the Earth's 10th parallel. She's a fellow at the New America Foundation. Her journalism has appeared in The Atlantic, The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and Harper's, among others. Her book, The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam, is now out on in paperback. And Eliza, we just talked about some of the things that you witnessed in Sudan and Nigeria. Now, your book also details a pretty perilous trip to Somalia, but I want to move on to Southeast Asia. You traveled there to Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines. And let's begin in Malaysia, which is a strongly Islamic country, extremely technologically advanced, quite wealthy, very different from what you saw throughout Africa. But their Christians account for a very small minority. And you spoke to a bride from a Christian family who secretly converted to Islam and was about to marry a Muslim man. Tell us about that conversation.
Well, I should say here that I traveled to Malaysia from Bridgewater Hill in New Hampshire, where I spent a good deal
well,
of
bravo.
My summers growing up. So I you know, from one woods to another. But this young bride belonged to a group of Aborigines called the Orang Asli Original People. There are about 100,000 left on the main peninsula, the Malay Peninsula of Malaysia. Now, these guys, these Orang Asli, follow their indigenous beliefs, which really tie them to the land and spirits of the land and the sky. But what's been happening is what anthropologists call the race to save the last lost souls. And it's a competition, very heated, between state-sponsored Muslim missionaries and Christian missionaries, primarily South Koreans, who come to Malaysia in order to save souls. So among these people who live in treehouses and, you know, are increasingly reached by roads, religion is a form of globalization, and it comes down the road with missionaries, including Baha'i missionaries, which I found unusual. So this young woman had secretly converted to Islam without telling her father. She had been raised a Christian, kind of, because her father had adopted Christianity, because he saw it as a way to save his people from Islam. And I met her on her wedding day, and she was pretty terrified up in her treehouse to come marching down the hill and tell her dad, guess what, I converted already. Because the idea would be once she converted to Islam, she would lose her Aboriginal identity. She would become part of the Malay majority, because in the Constitution it says to be Malay is to be Muslim, and she would be lost to her family. So that's just one of those super interesting tensions that I watched unfold in familial dramas.
And there are so many stories of that in your book. Another story of a couple, Christian missionaries, Gracia and Martin Burnham, who were captured by a criminal gang with ties to Al-Qaeda. They were held for a long time. Martin didn't make it. You later spoke to Gracia, who said, jihad is a career move. So not just a form of globalization, but a career move. After your reporting, do you believe that?
I do think, here's what I think. I think that the most important religious struggles, religious clashes of our time, aren't those between Christianity and Islam. They're those inside of Christianity and Islam. They're those between Christians and Christians, Muslims and Muslims. And this form of violent Islam that supports jihad by any means necessary. And, you know, along the edges of the Muslim world in Indonesia, you certainly see people are – well, this is actually in the Philippines where people are extraordinarily poor. There's no other job option besides kidnapping and becoming part of this group, Abu Sayyaf. And what legitimizes that? Well, these guys use religion to legitimize that. So there are certainly – there are all kinds of characters supporting all kinds of religious movements because it's in their interest to do so. And that's what Gracia was pointing out. And she was really, she is such a fine person. And I was just struck by her strength after her loss. She was shot, actually, when she was being rescued.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was shot and still returns to the Philippines in disguise, of all things, because she's such a celebrity there. And it was a great honor for her to travel with her a bit in the United States to look at what is this idea, and this is something we don't hear much about, of contemporary martyrdom within a Christian context. Because in many Muslim countries today, Christians are actually targeted as figures of the West, as outsiders, even though they may be born Christians in that country. We see this in Pakistan. We certainly see this in other places as well. And Gracia has become a spokesperson for that movement.
Well, now, the U.S. military power is focused on Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, keeping a very careful eye on Syria and Iran. Is U.S. foreign policy focused on the right place, or should it be on the 10th parallel, where these kind of passions and the willingness to become martyrs on both sides runs high?
Honestly, you know, American boots on the ground are problematic in most places. So that doesn't mean they're essential ways that we engage with our foreign policy. But let's take Somalia. Somalia is today the world's worst humanitarian crisis. It is the spearhead of the worst famine in 60 years, affecting more than 11 million people in Somalia, nearly 4 million. Now, how did this come to be? Is this famine simply a lack of food? And of course not. Famine never is simply a lack of food these days. What's happened is that in the south of the country, where the famine is at its worst, the people live under the control of a horrific group of militants called Al-Shabaab. This group was formed in the wake of an invasion of Somalia by neighboring Ethiopia that was backed by the United States in 2006. We helped to drive out a government, an Islamic government, that was just getting formed. It was for sure sheltering at least three members of Al-Qaeda. There were serious problems. But unfortunately, what we did was help form a popular Islamic rebellion that rose up against the U.S. And those are the guys who are now kidnapping people, making sure that starving people aren't allowed to leave areas where they control. So our foreign policy in Somalia has been extremely problematic. And I have to say, I've been so impressed, particularly with Secretary Clinton, who has been extremely vocal in trying to change this policy. But it's an uphill battle.
Well, a lot of battles being fought here, detailed in your book. There's so little time with you, but I want to let listeners know that they can see Eliza Griswold this week. She's going to be at the Amos Fortune Forum at the Meeting House. That's in historic Jeffrey Center on Friday, August 19th. For more on that event and her book, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Eliza. Fascinating book, fascinating idea. I want to also, just if I can get you quickly before you go, what's going on along the 10th parallel a crusade or being framed as a crusade? And how does that change the nature of the conflict?
Here's the challenge. What I thought I was going to travel along this line and be able to explain to people why people believed what they did, and just the opposite happened. When people on the ground told me they were fighting a crusade or they were part of a jihad, whether that meant, usually that was, again, it was a contest inside their own religion. They were trying to be part of a group, a powerful group inside their own religion, and they used the other side as the perceived enemy to try to shore up control inside their own faith. So it's too easy and too dangerous to classify these as crusades and jihads. Do people believe they live their faith every day and die for that faith? They absolutely do. And that's what we really need to come to understand more profoundly.
Well, Eliza, I really want to thank you again. It's great talking to you in a fascinating book.
Thanks so much.
Eliza Griswold again there. Her book is The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. It's now out in paperback. Again, she'll be at the Amos Fortune Forum at the Meeting House in Jaffrey Center on Friday, August 19th. We have more on the event in her book at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you'd like to hear more from our 11 for 11 series, you'll also find it there. Coming up, quite another war going on in a new novel from Vanessa Veselka set in a fading industrial city and something that looks like America. After the BBC News, this is Word of Mouth.